What is justice? And where do we seek to find and achieve it? In this episode, we begin by talking about restorative justice. But the conversation soon turns to justice in the context of access to health care. Join me for this conversation with guests from the Faith Coalition for the Common Good in Springfield, Illinois. This is Justice Voices, eye-opening stories that need to be told, voices that need to be heard about justice, healing, and safer communities. This episode is brought to you with support from the Field Foundation of Illinois through a Healing Illinois grant administered by United Way of Central Illinois. Welcome. Today we are at the offices of Faith Coalition for the Common Good in Springfield, Illinois. And I have three guests joining us today, and I'm going to have each one of you introduce yourselves and say a little bit about you. And then we're going to get more into Faith Coalition, and we're going to turn our attention to the topic of restorative justice, because restorative justice is very much a part of what the Faith Coalition for the Common Good does and their mission in the community. And we want to learn more about that. We want to learn more about restorative justice. We also want to learn about restorative justice in practice and in real life situations. So, Tashiana, let's start with you. Introduce yourself to our audience.
Well, I'm happy to be here. My name is Tashiana Bankhead. I'm the Executive Director of Faith Coalition for the Common Good. I'm from Chicago, Illinois, and I came to Springfield to attend University of Illinois at Springfield. And so during that time, I pursued my undergraduate. I graduated with my master's in public administration with a certificate in community planning. In Chicago, I wasn't fully raised there, but I was raised in the Quad Cities, so had a lot of experience with diversity, with those who are with individuals or families coming in from different communities and countries, establishing a life there. So it really brought in a sense of belonging, but also education among culture. So that was one thing that brought me into like social justice as well as sociology. And so I'm very much interested in those two coming together as one. And so did AmeriCorps work, went into SIU workforce, and I found that I really wanted to work in public policy and changing things systemically for my community. And I found that community organizing was the way to go.
And here you are.
Yes.
Okay, and Vanessa?
Vanessa Knox, born and raised here in Springfield, graduated U of I here, or UIS we call it. And then that was with a bachelor's in legal studies. I had before that an associate degree in law enforcement administration. And while I was at UIS, just devoted my life to being an activist full time. I had a lot of experience with the Innocence Project, and I did my internship with them as well. Before that, the other internship I did was with Springfield PD. So the law enforcement tying into the law and community activism, that will kind of describe my life's work. Later got a master's in restorative justice from Vermont Law School, and it just furthered my love for restorative justice. So I've been a community activist basically since high school and increased that throughout the university while I was at university.
And you're a native of Springfield, is that right?
Born and raised, yes. And I'm proud of that. Some people here, they laugh and they say, well, why would you not go somewhere else? I like Springfield. I think it's a great family town. Chicago and all the other places are great to visit, great to do, different works and things there if you want. But I love Springfield. I think it's great. I think there's a lot of opportunity here. And people think that's bizarre, but yeah, I think it's a great town.
Well, speaking as another Springfield, Illinois native, I was born here myself, a little bit before you, but grew up away from here, but came back. And yeah, Springfield's a great place because of the people. That's what makes Springfield a great place. Kwani, tell your full name and who you are.
Okay. My name is Kwani Barney. I go by Q. I'm a community organizer for Faith Coalition for the Common Good, Transformational Justice. I'm an individual born and raised in Chicago, ended up in Springfield, been in trouble, got here in Springfield and changed my life around. Learned some things while I was here in Springfield, dealing with community organizing, be involved with the community. Everything that I'm doing now, I kind of planned out when I was incarcerated, and I'm acting it out now by the grace of God.
What I'd like to do for the rest of our conversation here is to talk about, first of all, Faith Coalition. What is it, and what's its mission, and what do you do, who do you do it with? And then let's talk about restorative justice. So first of all, Faith Coalition. What is it that you can tell us about Faith Coalition?
Faith Coalition is comprised of members of member organizations, whether they are faith communities, unions, not-for-profits. We come together along a set of values that we believe that racial and economic justice is something that we can organize around, and that's something that we can see in a community with if we're organizing effectively. So we come we talk to our community members, we talk to the decision makers on processes and also policies or procedures that we can change in the community that has a lasting impact on the community. So whether it's racial justice, whether it's transformational justice, environmental justice, all of these injustices play a factor on in communities. And so we talk to our decision makers about how do we change those policies? How do we change those procedures that it can reflect our community in a way where we're seeing social justice in a light? So we organize with our community members, we organize with our member organizations to move effectively for decision making.
That's the common good part. But let's talk about the Faith Coalition part.
Yeah, so we're under Gamaliel National Network, and so we follow this Gamaliel ladder, which we believe that our faith is what drives us. We know that some people are not doesn't have any like religion, but they have faith in something. They have we've been a part of a union or the Mother Jones, yes, the Mother Jones banquets. You can just feel the faith that they have when it comes to equity among workforces. So we know that people are driven by their faith and their values. So that's one aspect that we come across, is that we are an interfaith organization. We know that we have faith in something. We have values, and that's what we organize around our faith and our values.
Now, I'm part of the Greater Springfield Interfaith Association, which is people come and they represent different faiths, and we get together, we meet, and we talk about things of common interest. And in my view, at least, what differentiates the Interfaith Association from Faith Coalition is the Faith Coalition is not as concerned about pulling together all the faith communities, more concerned about translating faith into action in the community. And while those largely overlap, they're not entirely the same thing. Have I got that right?
We have more of a focus on justice issues. We've all spoke at Greater Interfaith Association. We've attended a lot of their events, and we love and work with a lot of those people there. We have rules that are governed by Gamaliel Network. They are one of the largest community organizing training networks there is in the country, and it's all through many different states. So they do want us to have the highest accountability. So whatever faith you have, that gives your accountability. No, most faiths are not going to have you do, most of them will have similar, not always beliefs, but similar amounts of accountability. You know, you have to have someone that is watching you, something that you're praying to or something that you're trying to abide by to do the best that you can possibly do. So we come together and we share that for justice. So that's one thing. You know, there's a lot of really good activists here that work with us. And that's why it's the Faith Coalition. So we have many different task force, and all of us go to either a church, mosque, synagogue, some type of a place of worship we go to. And we don't discuss always which one they have, you know, and or kind of compare it really too much, because we know it's a higher power that you're basing your accountability with. So that's what we expect from our members and board members and organizations that join us. And we work together just fine. Religion never is a problem with us. It's not at all. So I'm real proud of that, And there's usually something for just about everybody here. So I run the Transformational Justice Task Force. Others will run education, or they may run housing initiatives. They may have, Kwani has a new one, Rebuild the Future, just for people that are in the reentry community. So we all end up working together in some kind of way, but there's something for every justice interest you would have here.
Now, that brings us to you, Kwani. Tell us about what you do with Faith Coalition.
What I do with Faith Coalition is basically comes up with all the things that God put in my mind and prepared me to do when I was incarcerated, that I'm doing it out here in the community. Like to rebuild the future. That was a plan that I wrote while I was in there. And now it's a task force that's being presented out here in the community, where we go pass resources out to individuals that's being released from the pretrial fairness to reduce the recidivism rate. Other things dealing like, I'm involved with a lot of churches on the east side of Springfield, Illinois. So I talk and I associate with a lot of pastors.
Now, the east side of Springfield is predominantly, not entirely, but predominantly African-American, right?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And it's almost like 30 churches out here on this side of town. And what I do is I talk to the pastors at some churches.
I'd like for you to come back and repeat that, because Springfield is not the east side of Springfield. Springfield is not a big community. I mean, it's a medium-sized city. People from Chicago would laugh at that, but you know, at least here in central Illinois, it's one of the principal cities. It's the capital city of Illinois. The east side of Springfield is even smaller of that. And you're saying there are 30 churches within that geographic area.
Yeah, it's like 30 churches, almost a church on every block on the east side of Springfield, Illinois.
Religion is very much a part of that community.
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And my job is to go out and scout and talk to them churches about the different services and programs that we have for them, for the community, get them involved with the community, and also bring them pastors together to talk about things in the community, like with prayer walks or like with block parties, but bring everyone together in the community to work on, to see what's the problem we can work on and fix it.
So, as I see where Faith Coalition fits in, you're more interested in putting faith into action than trying to pull people of all sorts of different faiths together just for the sake of interfaith harmony. You're about interfaith action, interfaith community action. Is that right?
We want someone that already has a set of rules they abide by, that higher power. So when they have that, that's not to say they're better than someone else in the community, but say if you're wanting to work on school issues, the PTO doesn't discuss religion. They don't discuss a higher power or anything like that. But if you already draw people that already have acknowledged, yes, I have a higher power, I have a set of expectations that my God expects from me, then you have so much of the battle already won. Then you put that together and work on the justice issues. So you already have a set of rules for yourself that's going to govern how you deal with people. You know, there's not going to be a faith out there that says you're mean and nasty to people. You have to speak life, and you have to forgive, and you have to know that process, and your demeanor has to reflect what that higher power expects of you. So it's a very clever way that Gamaliel has come up with to gather people that will be the most productive for you, you see. And it's also, Gamaliel has an incredible amount of rules and things just with them, with how they run the meetings and how long a meeting should be. And some people, they come from church meetings or temple meetings, stuff. I'm like, well, gosh, well, you have to have food. You have to have it within an hour. You have to have this. You have to be on time. You can't just stay kind of talking about it for another 30 minutes like a lot of church functions will do. They're very strict with the expectations of what a meeting should entail, how long it should be, who should be running them, how they should be ran. We go through a week-long training. When I first got with them over 10 years ago, I'm like, I'm not taking off from work for a week to go to a university in Kenosha, Wisconsin. that's too long. We can just do something meeting somewhere, you know? And they kept encouraging, kept encouraging. It was one of the best things I'd ever went through. Not only do you meet an awful lot of people from different backgrounds, but you meet people with their ideas of what justice should be and what they feel should be worked on. Some people are so subject oriented, they only deal, like they want to take care of homeless, they only deal with that issue. Well, Faith Coalition, you're going to see what's the trouble with all kinds of justice issues, you see. So that it's appealing to a lot of people because of that.
Well, justice is an almost universal language. And it's one of those things that can bring people together. It's part of what I think of as the Spirit of God.
That's right.
That unites people. Now, let's turn to justice in action in a community. What's that look like? Kwani?
Well, we just was talking about faith. So when an individual values get violated, one of the values, once they believe in, they come and talk to us about it. And then we work on that situation. We put together an issue or action or try to address that problem, that thing that was violated, by them in the, from the community. And we go to the people at the table, maybe like the chief of police, and talk to him about what the community is saying, what's going on. And then we try to address it in an organized way and in a professional way to see if they are held accountable for what they are doing that violated that person's value, that violated that person's value, that what they believe in, if I'm saying that right, if I'm saying that correct.
Well, you are, because what you're describing are some of the essential aspects of restorative justice.
Yeah.
Somebody has been harmed. Somebody caused the harm. Accountability in action is part of restorative justice. But that's easier said than done.
Yeah.
And being able to bring people together to heal the harm is really the overarching objective of restorative justice. But oftentimes, the person causing the harm has suffered harm.
Right.
And when there's the expression, hurt people hurt people. And so it becomes one thing leads to another, and you end up healing both the victim of the harm and the perpetrator of the harm, because the perpetrator is also a victim of harm. Have I got that right, Vanessa?
Yes, many offenders are victims, and many victims are offenders. So some people tend to divide it up as offenders, let them do the time for what they did. We don't want anything to do with them, and they cast them off. Well, you can't cast off people in their 20s. They're not dying anytime soon. You're going to have to pay for them all this time. You know, there has to be some type of redemption and the belief that they can be repaired. But you also have to instill in the belief in them that they want to be repaired. And what the benefits of, or what the benefits you get from being repaired, you see. So restorative justice allowed us to put a cause for what is happening to us as well. So when you see people that are robbing the cars and taking different things and garages and all this stuff, a lot of times people say, well, what's scallywags? They're awful people. They suck. Why would they do something like that? When restorative justice got on the map and more people started caring about it, now you can see, well, little Johnny never had his mom. He never had his dad. He didn't have this. He never went to school. He had all of these barriers that are sitting there. So crime ends up being a result of those barriers. So at least restorative justice opens the door to understanding why Johnny is doing what he's doing or Sally's doing what she's doing. Not just the fact that it was done, cast them away. Well, when you cast them away, where are they supposed to go? They're too young to just sit there and die. I mean, they're going to still have, we have to still make space in our world for them and make it not only a space, but to understand what is going on. And once they've turned themselves around, repaired whatever is going on, work with them to continue to help others.
Well, that's a form of crime prevention or victimization prevention.
Mm-hmm.
And people who have listened to the earlier episodes of Justice Voices have heard me say often that one of the greatest needs, I believe, in justice policy is to shift from a punishment paradigm to a problem-solving paradigm.
That's right.
And restorative justice is a problem-solving paradigm. Now, one of the people who will be a guest in a future episode of Justice Voices is Ricky Brown.
Mm-hmm.
I'd encourage everybody to listen to Ricky Brown's story before I recorded it, but I think this would be a better episode to precede it, to kind of set the stage for it. But he tells the story of becoming a perpetrator of harm because of addiction and what it's like to look at other people and opportunities through the eyes of an addict. Mm-hmm. And his life has been dramatically changed. But he's also affiliated with Faith Coalition and is part of the family here. Kwani, can you give us like an example of a typical type of harm that you would be dealing with?
Not using names. Okay. I can give you an example. An individual called me, day before yesterday, but he locked up and they wouldn't let him out for pretrial fairness. They saying his priors was preventing them to release him for pretrial fairness. So I contacted my colleagues about the pretrial fairness. They just, it's new. And they told me that to let him know that he can go back in front of, every time he go in front of the judge, he can ask for pretrial fairness to be released. You know, it ain't just no one time. Every time he got a court date, he got a chance of getting out. Or if he have new evidence, he got a chance of getting out on pretrial fairness. And also, he was saying that any type of new evidence, it can help him get out on pretrial fairness. But the people end up letting him out for a whole day to go bury his son. And he got out at 6 in the morning and reported back at 5 p.m. They let him out for that whole day, so they saying why they can't let him out for pretrial fairness. He didn't run, he didn't leave, he didn't flee. And so I was like, that's something that he can use when he go in front of the judge next time and see can they be released on pretrial fairness. Something like that.
Any other examples that you can think of?
Well, one that comes to mind for me is when, and I specialize in people coming out of prison with reentry. That's always been my focus. We've seen quite a few different ones that are coming out, but they don't have either the medication that they need, nor the ID or the birth certificates and things to be able to get the ID. So when they are released, say they've done 5 years, time for them to come back home. Well, you have them come out. What it's turned into is a setup to go right back. If you're reliant on a medication and that medication requires identification and you don't have the documents to get the identification, then you're not getting that script. If you don't get that script, then psychosis can happen and many other things can happen. That gives them a much more propensity to do crime, to be able to eat. Because without the identification, you're not going to be able to get the link cards, and some food banks require it. Food giveaways have required that. You're not able to work. You're not able to set up other things to help yourself with it. So barriers come and they have no way of knocking the barrier down.
Without some help.
That's where we come in at. A gentleman in particular right now is in the hospital. He came to us trying to get an ID. Well, he needed a birth certificate to get that ID. Our expos, we pay for them to have a state ID or a driver's license. He can't get different services that he needs without that ID. His ID is expired. He didn't know where he was actually born, which county, And so I helped him get that taken care of, where we found out which county it was. He had some trauma that was centered around his delivery of being premature. And so now he has that info. He can go to the county or do it online and be able to get that birth certificate and then take it to Secretary of State to get the driver's license or the state ID that he needs. So we have some that have suffered for months, some of them for years, not being able to get that process taken care of for various different reasons. And so now he's in a worse situation where his health has failed him really bad right now. And when you don't have the proper ID and you're Medicaid or medical card eligible, you got to show ID for all that. So now he's very, very, very sick right now in a hospital. And if he makes it through, he has no ID to be able to get other services that he needs. We can try to vouch for him. I can say, this is this guy, I know him, and bring all the mail and all that type of stuff for him. But he doesn't have an ID to show who he is. So he can't get all of those services, you see? So that's a harm from the system that happens. He's locked into the system in a way where he has to only be a walk-in candidate for the community centers that will see him. You never know if they'll see you. You never know how long that will be. And so when you're dealing with problems such as diabetes or heart problems that are going to be lifelong issues that you're going to take care of, he couldn't get the actual testing strips to see how high his sugar was. He went in with an 800 glucose level.
And 200 is considered
the... I'm coming to every doctor's appointment now.
The limit.
So I went, I said, how can you still walk and live with the 800 glucose level? They said, because he's had this so long and no one knew, that his body is used to running on overdrive with this glucose level. So he went in the hospital, stayed a week. They let him out right under 400. That's still extremely high. Coma can still happen. Well, they give him a script that can't be filled because the normal scripts are three times a day to check. They give you enough test strips to check three times a day. He needs it like five times a day. So the pharmacist can't legally fill the script because it has to have pre-authorization from the insurance and something else signed from the doctor saying this is very, very necessary for him. So he went a month going back and forth, taking insulin, not knowing how high his sugar level was at the time. So one of the little places gave him one, but of course not enough test strips to last longer than a week or two. So he's right back in the same situation. No pre-authorization's done. The doctor actually said they're not going to give authorization. Well, what is he supposed to do? So we can help in the meantime. I go sit at the doctor's appointment, write every single thing down, demand to have a copy of that summary. And they look like, well, who is this? That was the only way he was able to get an extra test machine that day. If I didn't come with him and he just muddled in there with these 500 and 600 sugar levels, he wouldn't have been able to understand what they're wanting him to do. We brought a garbage bag of medicine, a actual garbage bag bigger than this one. They took half of it away. A lot of it was expired. Some were multiple medicines with different dosages. So how do you know which ones to take? You have a sugar level that's 500. You can't see. So I have to go in there and I give him the insulin and the testing machine and do all that for him. And he needs it five times a day. So me and other relatives are going in there to do that for him. How long can that last? I'm calling the pharmacy every couple of days. Where is it at? Where is it at? Just to finally, after 2 months, to say, well, the number that he has is for a managed care Blue Cross. And that's the same number as a medical card, but we have no proof for the medical card. We spent 8 hours in one day between public aid office, two different pharmacies, and the doctor's office just to be able to understand, oh, from the pharmacist, she said, he has straight medical card, not the managed care anymore. Same number, but they didn't run it as the medical card. So he went without checking his sugar all this time, taking higher doses of insulin and hoping it's going to work. So the injustices that we see are not just from DOC, probation, the courts, attorneys. It's from the doctors. It's from the nurses. It's from the schools. It's from all kind of different people. It's not just one. People see court shows and they think, oh, you know, bad situation with the prison. It's not. It's with so many different things. If I would have went in there with a sugar level half of his, I would have had a better outcome immediately. Now he's fighting for his life, septic in the hospital, and he may not make it.
So a friend of mine who has a doctorate as a nurse practitioner and who works in the public health area here in Springfield told me that Springfield is one of the most resource-rich communities in the state in terms of medical resources. And yet we have some of the worst public health outcomes.
Yes.
Particularly in that part of the community. We were talking about the East Side, the predominantly African-American part of the community. And why? It's because the people who need the resources, there's a gap that needs to be overcome to bring the people that need the resources into a position to receive the resources. And a lot of that is because of these systemic sorts of hurdles, particularly when somebody's getting out of prison. I mean, that's a situation. I know we have a common friend also, Juan Huerta, who works in the Secretary of State's office now. And he was just telling me that the Secretary of State is trying to make it easier for people to receive their IDs because they go to prison and sometimes when they get out, they just have nothing. Department of Corrections, Illinois Department of Corrections, is trying to improve their system to be able to overcome that hurdle. Now, you mentioned I want to get back to this this expo, the Restorative Justice Expo, where that program tries to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. But what I hear you saying is what you're doing is trying to correct unfairness, injustice that exists, not necessarily because somebody is got a bad mind and doing mm-hmm. someone harm, but because the system that they live in and that they're dependent upon for something like medical care
yes.
is not working for them. And so here comes Faith Coalition in to help close the gap. That's restorative justice.
But it's also, David, to give them a seat at the table, because what has traditionally been done historically in America, in every state, is the wealthy, the elected officials, the higher named people, they are the only ones that get a seat at the table. Regular common people don't. This stuff doesn't happen to people that have a lot of clout. What if you don't have a mom or dad that was an elected official or has lots of money and their name is on two or three schools and different programs and scholarships around town? Everyone doesn't have that. Everyone doesn't desire that either. So the table should have everyone that's impacted and concerned about it, not just certain people. Because a lot of the people that sit on these committees and boards and stuff, they're, and I don't want to call them out. It's hard not to, but I don't want to call them out. But they don't have anything to do with what they're sitting on the board for. When I deal with this every day, I get phone calls before I get out of the bed. We got home from the hospital after midnight last night just to take care of other things by 6. I have a very nice, beautiful young lady that has a broken kneecap. March 1st, and there's not one doctor in Springfield that will do a surgery for her.
Why is that?
They said, we just don't have, you need this and that. We don't have that here. They're sending her to another town. I said, what do you mean? People get knee replacements. They fix their knees all day long.
Had one myself.
I watched my white mother fall I wasn't there when she fell. Right after she fell, had surgery by morning. Why doesn't this person get it?
I'm assuming you're talking about somebody who's
of color. Same kind of insurance.
Same kind of insurance.
Yes.
Okay.
Medicaid as a backup, and I don't want to say the insurance name because then they try to sue you for that. But people who have insurances that they're getting from public aid are not getting the same treatment as other retired people or folks that have a managed care and just Medicaid as a backup. They're not getting the same care. This 30-some-year-old girl was crawling around her house after she fell down her steps at a Section 8 house that only had railings on one side. They knew she was suffering in a house with a completely broken kneecap. And she was stuck inside the house. There's no ramp on it because she normally walks and stuff. So she was stuck. It's a fire hazard. I had to call all kind of people just to be able to put my name out there just for her to get a wheelchair. And it was only a used wheelchair that's already broke. If anyone that has private insurance broke their kneecap, they're having a surgery right away. They are telling this girl since March 1st. It's the middle of June. Well, we'll get you in Litchfield after you come back and do another MRI for us. We had to carry her out of her house. Me, my husband, and teenage daughter to my car. That was the only time she's gotten out of her house in over 2 months.
These things ought not to be. They ought not to be in a community that cares about everyone in the community. And so this is a justice issue.
Mm-hmm.
A social, you can call it social justice, whatever you want to call it. And these are some of the things that I'm hearing Faith Coalition deals with on a daily basis, that you deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And God bless you for doing that. Anything that you'd like to share, Tashiana, particularly here closing up?
Yeah, we talked a lot about, you know, just individual situations that happens. And although Faith Coalition doesn't provide direct services, we know that direct services is needed. Even when they come here, like community members come here and they want to do something about it, we also see that there are barriers to them actually moving in their power, using their voices. If you don't have an ID, how can you get to that next meeting with the sheriff? If you don't have, you know, if your family is suffering from asthma, which on the east side of Springfield, a lot of children and family members are, how do we think about the systemic changes or the things such as these injustices or equity in schools when we have something so prevalent that we have to think about now? If we're thinking about, you know, food or food scarcity, or what I say is the food apartheid. If I'm thinking about my next meal, how do I also think about these social issues in my community? And so we organize people to be at the table, but through the Transformational Justice Expo, we know that there are certain things that the community needs before they're able to think beyond their current circumstances, and even use that current circumstance to fuel them into having those hard conversations with our decision makers, having these hard conversations with those who have the authority to make things happen. So that's why we go into Transformational Justice Expo, because we want to eliminate those barriers, but also give them a sense of dignity to be able to say, I have an idea, I have a name change, I have expungement, you know, I don't have to be held to my past in a way that they once were. So
basically, you're problem solvers.
Yes, we go the extra mile. I don't get paid for any of the stuff that I do for them, none. And it's because I know it needs to be done.
Okay,
and
back
they
up,
do all kind of extra
up,
stuff.
Back up to that. So you aren't paid in the position that you're in. This is volunteer work you're doing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Out of pure heart.
That's right, because he needed me at the doctor's appointment. The other one needs me there at the doctor's appointment. If I didn't make the phone calls for them, and know what to say to them, they wouldn't have had the help that they have. You have people dying here in Springfield because they have the wrong insurance, or they're just looked at as a lower class. No one's looking at the dignity. When she mentioned dignity, that's a huge thing. When I have 3 degrees, I can, you know, I'm unemployed actually right now, but I know my husband has a pension. I know that I'll end up getting on somewhere soon. I have that ability to do that. When you're talking about people that don't have that, maybe they got out of college to raise a kid, or they had a bad divorce, or whatever happened to them that put them in that situation, you can't take the chance on them becoming hopeless. If you become hopeless, that's when drugs set in. That's when the propensity to do crime sets in. That's when the accountability goes out the door.
And thinking that you're going to solve that problem by sending somebody to jail or to prison
doesn't fix it.
Doesn't fix it at all.
Because the reason they wanted to do drugs, the reason they wanted to get up in the morning and have a need to feel high, you have to feel low to want to have to feel high. So if you don't fix that reason that someone feels so low, then they're going to keep getting high because you didn't fix the reason why they feel low. So going to prison, taking them out, that's like putting a kid in another room for an hour or so. It doesn't change what the problem was. It just keeps them away from it a little while. That's it. So when they get out, it's not a coincidence 3 out of 4 immediately go back, because the problem is not being taken care of. So what I did for this gentleman that's in the hospital, I just wrote it out, and they looked at me like, come in here all arrogant like your staff or something. They just look at you like that. I said, well, this is what I'm requesting. I am on his emergency contact. This is what I'm requesting. And I wrote the list like any doctor or social worker or something there would have. He needs an insulin pump. We want this as soon as possible. We need infectious disease to come to see why, septic. We need this, 10 things on there. And they just looked. I said, I do want it to be scanned into his chart. And they just looked like deer in a headlight. But his numbers are better, and he's going to have more people to come in. You see, so you have to be available to be in the face in a nice way, not mean and nasty, but have those expectations of them. Because somewhere along the line, these people have fallen through the cracks. They've completely fallen through, and they have no resources to be able to get back out of that crack unless one of us go and help them. You see, one of the people that came and it had brought tears to my eyes, and I felt so bad crying about it at the expo. Tyshana was there, and she authorized and came up with all this to be able to pay for a birth certificate and driver's license. A lot of people look at it and say, well, what is that going to do for somebody? Well, if you got a job that's getting ready to come up and you have to have a background check for it, or you have to have the ID or driver's license for whatever the reason is, and you don't have $40 to do it, nor $25 or $30 for the birth certificate for it, then you're not getting it. So this person has had such an incredible amount of trauma. And on top of it, not to know which county or where he was born. He didn't know. So that's a circumstance that most people cannot relate to. So can you imagine the robbing of dignity that he's had? He tries to show an expired ID. And if they're just busy enough at public aid, they won't look at it to see that was expired last year or the year before. They just look, that kind of looks like it, and they went on. And I even told him, I said, well, you can't go with his fake ID, or not fake ID, but an expired one. That's not going to work. He said, that's all I got. And he showed it to him. He was able to get him a link card. He's a severe diabetic and has no extra nothing to be able to afford the type of diet he's going to have. So when you tell poor people, well, you're a diabetic now, you better have all the fresh vegetables and all the stuff that you need and all these other things, and they're not used to eating it, who's supposed to help make that happen? So we do a lot of work that's helping people in the meantime, and it's advocating for them, and it's helping them to navigate the system. That's what people underestimate. When you're educated and your parents were educated, or you come from people that know how to talk and do business and everything, you know how to call them and get it done. I get calls all day. I call it and I get it done. He got his one touch monitor to see what he has. The other one, she has an appointment. It's out of town, which I told her don't settle for throwing them, making you go to some other county somewhere. But at least one doctor is looking at this and he sees the tragedy that's happened to this young girl with a broken kneecap. He says, why has it been this long? He, as a doctor, can't even see what would happen for 3 months to make you sit there with a broken kneecap. So they gave her all of these pain medicines. Well, what's going to happen if you sit with pain medicine all day long with no other physical therapy, no other things to help it, no surgery? What's going to happen? You're going to be a drug addict. Then they're going to say, well, they're a drug addict. Then all your credibility goes out the door.
You know, when I asked for concrete examples, I really didn't realize what a floodgate it would open. But that's a story that needs to be told. And your voices are voices that need to be heard. And God bless you for what you're doing and for being here for people. Because who would they turn to? Now, there may be, I know there are others who do things to try to solve these problems. Pastors, people in community service organizations, volunteer organizations, everybody who is helpless because they don't know where to turn, hopeless because they're helpless, feeling this loss of dignity. What a godly thing to do, to be that person who touches their lives and helps them find the help they need, the resources they need, and the dignity they need, because somebody knows who they are, whether they've got an ID or not, and cares. What more fundamental human need could there be? So again, I say, God bless you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for joining us for today's conversation, which is the first of a series of episodes to be published with support from the Field Foundation of Illinois through a Healing Illinois grant administered by the United Way of Central Illinois. Our next episode will feature a conversation with a woman who, after being sent to prison 9 times, became a prison guard. You won't want to miss her story of exploitation, abuse, and along the way, gaining a unique perspective as an insider on both sides of prison bars. To make sure you hear that and other episodes, hit the subscribe or follow button, the like button if you're watching on YouTube, and share the link to our website on social media, justicevoices.org. That's justicevoices, all one word, .org. See you in our next episode. This is Justice Voices, eye-opening stories that need to be told, voices that need to be heard about justice, healing, and safer communities.